Hey,
How are you today?
how are you? I'm okay. I guess it's ups and downs every day. When you wake up either in a down mood and or numb, and then you get up at the evening, and then it could be vice versa as well.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, for sure. 100%. It's like trying to adapt to the new normal, however your body and mind can respond to it. So I totally understand.
Yeah, I think especially since we were reading news and developments during the so-called peace talks with the Russians in Turkey, right? And a lot of Ukrainians would be like having mixed feelings about that because how do you even negotiate on, on genocide, right? How do you negotiate your way out of a genocide? But then you read about these Russians promising pullbacks, and then you have this night when we had terrible bombings in Lysychansk and Chernihiv, and a lot of people just didn't live to see the morning light. And
Yeah.
yeah, it's a complete roller coaster of feelings, naturally.
Yeah. Absolutely. I'm really glad to see Yulia is on the call with us today,
Hi.
already. Hi,
Thank you so much
Yulia.
for inviting me.
No, absolutely.
Okay. Awesome. So, listen up, folks. This is a space where we amplify Ukrainian voices, and we also, by doing so, trying to decolonize Ukraine conversations on Twitter. So, in the last month and before that, even we saw millions, and we know there are so many Ukrainians with perfect English, and they share their stories across all social media platforms. Yet, unfortunately, the conversations about Ukraine are still dominated by foreign, Western, mostly white, and mostly male folks. And not only it continuously robs Ukrainians of their agency, it also perpetuates outdated, misleading, and false narratives about Ukraine and Ukrainians. And we want to end this, and we want to foster a relaxed, safe, and chill space for Ukrainian voices to express themselves, and to do so without the need of fitting Western boxes. And the rest of you who are not Ukrainians, you can use the space to educate yourself and to maybe decolonize your own views of Ukrainians if needed.
I'd like to introduce everyone to Yulia Tymoshenko. Not last time we were talking, Yulia, you were like, not the prime minister.
Here's the joke. Yeah, the joke comes in.
Yeah.
It's always there, right?
Yes, it's always there.
But Yulia is an
Yulia.
amazing social media activist. I hope you don't mind me calling you that.
Oh,
Yulia
yeah.
kicked off basically the wave of sort of English language, social media, educational content on Ukraine on Instagram, and has been doing a lot of work since then to make sure that Ukrainians are heard and seen, and that we actually are the ones who are creating our own narratives and speaking for ourselves. So, Yulia, please, if you'd like to introduce yourself, if I missed anything, please go ahead, and then we'll jump into a couple of questions for you.
No, this was great. Thank you so much, Valeria. You always like have this a great way of introducing me and always like highlighting the fact that I kind of somehow like started that social media trend in English about Ukraine, which is I really appreciate for this kind of recognition that's always coming from you. And I'm really grateful to you guys for inviting me and letting me speak more, because I feel like I do a lot of like posts and I write a lot, but sometimes like I don't have enough of these like English speaking conversations because I'm still like in Ukraine, going on about different things. So I'm really grateful for this space. And yeah, overall, I kind of grown used to the fact that people call me like the social media activist for the last like 2 months. I guess that's another title that I'm going to carry, but I'm just a very regular Ukrainian. I was born and grew up in the Zaporizhzhia, Kyiv region, Ukraine. It's like a small town that is currently in the gray zone where the Russian army is still occupying the nearby villages and sometimes comes into ours as well. And that's a whole different, like, bizarre thing in itself. But then I sort of left and I studied abroad in the university in NYU Abu Dhabi. And then I came back last year and started my career in Kyiv and had a pretty normal young life as one has in the beautiful capital of Ukraine until, you know, everything with Russia started sort of raising as like a big tension. And obviously on February 24th, I became also an internally displaced person now. So a lot of titles, a lot of things, but I don't even know if I have like enough words to encompass my experience, but I'm looking forward to your questions into the conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. And you feel to share whatever you want to, you know, whatever you would like to share at the moment. And this is something that we ask every fellow Ukrainian these days. I mean, the question, how are you, does not make any sense for anyone anymore, and you don't know how to answer it. But, you know, at least I hope your family is doing okay. And at least, how's your family? Are they all safe, more or less?
So I'm in Lviv with my mom, and I left Kyiv together with my mom on the second day of the war. But my dad and my grandparents remain in Zaporizhzhia. They are okay physically, but it's definitely really hard mentally because they're sort of now cut off from the world. Mm. They do get like electricity sometimes with like some sort of like glitches, and it would be like turned off because the fightings are happening around. But yes, it's definitely really difficult for them because they sometimes have like very good days when they call me and they feel like very cheerful. But then sometimes like I could hear that my dad is really struggling because he has those days when he thinks like, oh no, like everything is lost. You need to like get out of Ukraine, move out because like you won't have anything to come back to. And I'm like, don't say that because it stresses me out. Like I'm making a really kind of conscious choice of staying in Ukraine right now because I sort of like I want to be here for as long as I can because I don't want anybody to tell me that I need to get out of my home, not by force at least. Absolutely. I'm happy that they're still alive, and that's like the lowest threshold these days, and they have everything they need. They have food, they have essential medicine because a person from my village like volunteered basically on the risk of their own life to go out of town and buy medicine in like a nearby town and bring it to the people with like cancer and the elderly. And it just amazes me how far people go to help out each other.
Absolutely.
Yeah, these days. So yeah, but thanks for asking about my family.
Yeah, I mean, we're all living it, you know, especially first days, these conversations I remember clearly with my parents as well, you know, like every hour, should you go, should you stay? And they decided to stay eventually, which now I respect. But at the same time, you know, a number of times a day, you think all the worst things that can happen to them. And of course, this is something you have to just at some point accept that they're this is their choice. And as my dad said something that first like shocked me recently, but then I totally understood. He said to me like, you know what, there are worse things than dying in this situation. And I was at first like, what do you mean? And he's like, you know, I imagine different situations when I leave and leave my home behind and there is no opportunity for me to come back. And he's like a man in his early 60s. He says, like, for me, like, dying is literally not the worst outcome in this situation.
Yeah, it's shocking because like a few, like I think a month prior, like I started having this conversation about like what would we do if the war actually happens. I think beginning of January, because I started feeling very uneasy with all the news coming up. And I remember talking to my dad about like the plan of leaving, where we would go, and everything seemed like very hypothetical and theoretical. I'm like, yeah, like, but let's like imagine. It's like, it's not going to happen, but let's imagine. But even then, my dad like held really strong position of saying that he's not going to leave no matter what happens, like that I have to leave and I have to take my mom, but he's going to stay. And that was a very difficult discussion because I couldn't sort of like understand why he's saying this and why he's staying. But I can imagine that for him, leaving home would be like way worse. And he actually, back then, I thought that he was joking. He said that, like, yeah, if they come here to our village, I'll rather, like, you know, die, but I'll take at least one or two with me, because he has like a hunting gun. And I was treating it as a joke back then. And then when it actually happened, when they did like enter the village and everything, I realized that, and like I'm having continuous conversations with my dad, and his mental health is in a very difficult place. Yeah. And I'm starting to like, you know, fearing that that was not a joke, because he keeps saying that they like, they keep coming and robbing people and like stealing like from people's food and stuff. And the morale of the people in the village is really kind of like deteriorating, and they keep like hating what is happening. So yeah. Just like going from thinking that that was a joke to a realization that like he's like that serious about it in a span of like a month is absolutely crazy.
Yeah. And you know, the situation has changed so much, and our emotions have changed. And as Maxim was saying, you know, one day you feel one thing, another day you feel in one day you can feel three different types of emotions and ups and downs. And it and this is like for us who are, you know, not under occupation and in relative in safety, and it must be so tough on people who are experiencing all of these things under occupation and living in constant fear. So all thoughts as well with your family who are there. Julia, I wanted to ask you a little bit about your sort of what drove you to really start using your social media accounts and your social media platforms to educate people. I know you've spoken before about really realizing that, you know, there were not many Ukrainian voices speaking out about the situation, but I was just wondering if you could tell us a little bit about what motivated you to really start using social media to fight for Ukraine.
So I think, I've had my Instagram page for many years, where I like sort of used it as like this little diary of my experience of studying abroad. And I've always sort of been using it as like to tell Ukrainians about my experience and just like how my education is going, how like I'm learning about these other cultures that I've experienced throughout those years. And I did from time to time had like more socially inclined like posts. Like I posted about Black Lives Matter when it was happening in 2020. I also talked about like feminism and other topics that are really important. And I talked about like the COVID vaccines, which is in itself is a very interesting also. And for me, it was mostly like bringing my perspective from what I learned abroad to the Ukrainians over the years. And I mostly like, I think, posted in Ukrainian. But then it sort of like flipped a little bit, because I realized that right now there is something really big going on with my home. And I have this like also audience, and like mainly my friends and people I know from the university or from like the time that I traveled who are foreigners. And in my experience abroad, I realized that people know so little about entire Eastern Europe. But in like Ukraine specifically, but also other countries and cultures, that it's so frustrating and sad. Like it's, and even like, and I'm talking not only about like the common people, like obviously, I mean, people in Ukraine probably don't know the history about like Latin America or something. But even like about the biggest sort of like historic events or just the fact that like Eastern Europe is very different from like Russia. It's like not a monolith. And sorry, you're gonna hear the VDB, like, which is ending of the air raid siren in Lviv, because I'm really close near the city council.
Is it air raid?
Yeah. It's finished. Like the threat has passed. Yeah, but it's really loud because.
Can we hear it?
I don't know if you can hear it.
I can hear it.
You can hear it?
Yeah. Yeah.
No, it says like that'd be.
Yeah.
Oh my god. Well,
like I will come closer to the window. Yeah, I don't know if you can hear it, but it's like speaking. Yeah. Yeah, so basically, I was saying about the. But I'm talking more about also like what you would deem as like very educated, intellectual, like people, like these spaces. And I went to like one of the most like sort of like liberal schools, NYU. Which is known to be this like very kind of like international and where people care about all of these like social topics and social issues, like the wars in like Middle East or like in the repressions in China and etc. Everything was really talked about on the large scale in classrooms and stuff. But whenever there was any conversation about Eastern Europe, it was mostly from the perspective of like former USSR countries or former Russian Empire, and it always had the sort of like the attention on Russia as the key player in the region, which always like really frustrated me, because very seldomly my professors or even my classmates focused on other ethnicities or countries or any nations that have been like impacted by Russian rule for centuries. And just like the fact that like, you know, I mean, I've been like, when I introduced myself to people like in the States and I said like, oh, I'm from Kyiv and I'm from Ukraine, immediate was like, oh, I don't know anything about Ukraine, but I know about Russia. And they go and tell me these like fun facts they know about Russia.
Yeah. Which is, we all know that.
Which is like, who abroad did I ask? Like, I don't, like, and it's always frustrated me. Like, I know this, like, narrative of, like, shared history has been, is, like, so penetrated in the Western idea of the post-former Soviet bloc or whatever they call it. But it's, like, very, like, I wish that sometimes people were like, oh, you're from Ukraine. I know this thing about Russia. Russia killed this many Ukrainians in this, like, other century. Fun fact that I know. It's never that. It's always some sort of, like, I love Russian borscht, and I'm like, it's not Russian. Or, like, this other thing, like, St. Petersburg is great. And I'm like, yeah, also home to, like, people who have repressed my country.
It was built by our slaves.
Yes, was built by Ukrainians. Yeah, so like that kind of, like, I never understood why like there is like such a huge perspective. I mean, like I have an argument that also like a lot of, specifically I'm talking about American institutions because I haven't had experience of studying in like European universities. I hope it's somehow like different, which I doubt. But like in American institutions, there is a lot of these courses or majors that are like usually named Russian and Slavic studies, but it's always Russian as like, you know, equating it with Slavic. And once I like sort of like went through the courses or the things that they cover, again, it's mostly everything that has to do with Russia, but not with other actual Slavic cultures.
It's only now just tiny bit changes, because I even remember, I'm like old enough to remember when I first came into knowledge about all these departments in Western universities that study Ukraine, and they were all called Russian studies or, you know, like Russian and Eastern European studies. And the majority of, you know, things that they would do there would be 90% Russia or 95% Russia, and everything else was just like a bonus. And then, of course, I mean, we with Valeria, we had terrific guests before, and we talked a lot about how colonial cultures the cultures of colonizers actually erasing the knowledge about colonized cultures to the point that the all conversations are always end up centering the colonizer, in this case, Russia. Even if you talk about Ukrainians or Belarusians, yes. So who else?
Exactly. But yeah, I was sort of drifting away there. Sorry to like answer Valeria's question because I went on like a different route.
Here. Yeah, this is like, exactly. This is your space. This is your space and you claim it and you do whatever you want with it. I really wanted to ask you about the stuff that you post on Instagram, and I'm a huge fan of it. And you know why? Because for a simple reason. I mean, I come from journalism, and I'm always part of these conversations. You know, they're highbrow conversations about Ukraine. Even if they're interesting, they're still pretty much boring for the majority of people. But when I go to your Instagram and the stuff that you post on Ukraine, it's so human. And when the war started, this is one of the most like humanizing posts explaining Ukraine I've ever seen. And the first one that kind of, you know, took over me, and I'm still a huge fan of it. You posted on about first days of war. Kind of slides on Instagram. Mm-hmm. And one thing, I just want to read it because it was like so powerful. So you just basically, you list things that happened as a diary with you during first hours of the war. And there is one, it says 5 a.m. in the morning. I open my eyes unprompted and think to myself, why did I wake up so early? I reach out for my phone and see the message from my dear friend that reads, God, please be safe. It started. And 5:10, I hear the first explosion outside. I wish this could be a firework. I suddenly want to throw up as the heavy chest pains burns me on the inside. My worst nightmare is here. I cannot breathe. I'm paralyzed. I think every single Ukrainian knows that time slot and that feeling. I think we all felt it. Valeria, I think I remember, and I think I will remember this 5 a.m. thing for the rest of my life, because this is exactly how I felt. Like I had full-on panic attack.
Yeah, for sure. And it's almost now, you know, part of our collective trauma. I feel like that's what, you know, I think that point in time is the point in time that changed our lives forever. And, you know, your words as well were just, I got shivers when Maxim was reading them.
Me too.
Yeah, but thank you so much for it. But I wanted really to ask you, what kind of reaction do you have? Because this is definitely different from what you posted before the war in terms of intensity and of what you share. Have your reactions also changed to what you post and what people, especially foreigners, how do they feel about it? Do you feel more support, more engagement because of it?
Well, yeah, I guess like before, just like almost like a month before the war actually started, I made that like previous post sort of like explaining a very like simple facts about like, you know, the 8 years of the war and how much it impacted Ukraine, but also like tying it up to the recent events of like the troops build up on the border and what Ukrainians are feeling is this like, you know, emotional terror. And that post, because it went like sort of viral, and that's how Valeria saw me as well and how we became friends with her on social media, it brought already a lot of people who really cared. But still under that post, obviously, a bunch of like Russians or people, I don't know, like with other kind of like ideas, they saw it and they came under it, and there was like a lot of hate, like comments, and I received some of the hateful messages. Like, still, like 75% of the messages I received then were like incredibly supportive and great. That it was mostly also from the countries that know what it is. Like, it was the Baltics, Georgia, yeah, Moldova, like all of these countries that have been impacted by the Kremlin's crimes in the past. And it was great to see this sort of solidarity, but not only, like, people from all around the world, I think, like, have messaged me, like, from Brazil or Australia. But the hateful comments were, like, you know, oh, like, you don't know what you're talking about. Russia would never, like, invade Ukraine. We're brother nations. We would never, like, kill our brothers and sisters.
The classic.
This is, like, coded racist language, as I call it now. Yeah.
Yeah, my favorite thing. And I, like, even back then, I already, like, was like, I don't have the energy to sort of engage with it. And I sort of, like, didn't. Like, I responded to a few until, like, I realized that this is draining me way too much, and it's, like, completely pointless to talk to most of those people.
Yeah.
With this post that you read that already happened on the 24th, fifth or something, like, I mean, after the invasion happened, I think I haven't actually been getting any of the hateful comments, or there are not any, like, Russian bots or trolls or anyone in my DMs. I have been, like, I've got one which was kind of very hilarious, because, like, that's a super interesting topic that, like, I'm ready also to talk about a lot, but it was somebody, like, I don't know, somebody from, like, West, I think, based on their, like, name. But they're sort of, like, responded to my story when I'm showing that I'm leaving Kyiv and saying, like, oh, this is a very feminist of you to leave your city. Why you're not joining the army and fighting? Mm-hmm. And they had, like,
oh,
this huge, like, you know, list of, like, I don't know, like, you know, calling me, like, a coward and stuff, and for having, like, double standards and everything. And then yet again, they, like, responded to me, like, on another story, saying, like, something, like, in support of Russia. And I just, like, couldn't, like, let it go. So I literally went to them and, like, just told them that, like, oh, I really wanted to tell you fuck you before I, like, block you. And once I said that, like there were, like, 5 minutes, because I forgot to actually block that person. Once I said that, they were like, oh, I'm really sorry, I didn't want to, like, hurt you. Like, I'm just want to, like, express solidarity with all Ukrainian people. And I'm like, wow, I wish me telling someone to go fuck themselves always worked like this.
Yeah.
This is incredible.
I wish it worked on Russia.
I wish everybody, like, turned, like, off like that in a minute. But yeah, but mostly, like, I don't, like, engage with, and I don't receive a lot of, like, those hateful comments. Actually, it's a lot of solidarity, support. I remember in the first days, like, a bunch of people would send me, I don't know, like, why, but I didn't, like, ask for it, but people would send me, like, pictures and videos from the protests in, like, different parts of the world, which was incredible. Like, I probably should have saved all of that in, like, a specific, like, album on my phone, because it was, like, very beautiful to see. Or, like, sometimes people, a lot of, like, actually Polish people, or, like, people from the Baltics, or any other people who, like, volunteer or do stuff, they would, like, message me and tell me all the things they've done to show support, which is incredible just to read and see. But I also feel like it's important for those people to share and for their work to be recognized. And I always try to respond to them, like, personally, and, like, thank them, because, like, everyone who's doing something, even if it's just, like, raising awareness and, you know, sharing Ukrainian voices or educating their peers in, like, offline spaces, it's already a lot. But also people who are, like, up on the ground donating, collecting humanitarian aid,
yeah,
organizing, like, supplies to Ukraine, because, like, we need a lot of, like, helmets and, like, the body armors and stuff. It's just, yeah, wonderful to see. Or, like, people would send me pictures of them blocking the trucks going to Belarus with, like, the Russian plates. And I'm like, I don't know why they feel like that I'm the person to share it with, but I'm really grateful that they do this, because it sort of, like, lets me know that we're in this together, and
it does help.
An incredible support. Yeah.
I think you've also become sort of the, like, I don't know. I think people just want to make sure that you know that they're doing a lot, and it's just quite nice to see that. I think I've been getting quite a few questions of like, oh, how can I help more? What can I do? Who can I donate to? What do you recommend I do? And it actually also, as you say, like I tried to reply personally, but it gets so tiring after one point.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you, if you we have the time right now, what would you recommend our audiences who are not in Ukraine, who are not Ukrainian, what would you recommend they do to support Ukraine right now? What would be your top three?
I mean, first one about the donations. And I think, I mean, you've spoken about it a lot and shared a lot of like resources. The best thing I feel like, if you know somebody from Ukraine as a foreigner, if you have a friend, if you have like, I don't know, a person you know, ask them if they know somebody like in need. Most likely they will have friends, acquaintances, or maybe family, even if they don't live actually in Ukraine right now. If they're abroad, they would probably know somebody who has been impacted, because I don't know how in this point you like don't know somebody who's impacted. Ask them whether those people need some sort of like financial donations. It's for those obviously who can make those donations. By the way, I don't know if you hear my washing machine, but if you do, I'm sorry. It's like really loud. But yes,
no worries. It's fine.
So I feel like donating directly to the people, and I think like that helps way more. Like obviously there are big organizations who do, like, not talking about Red Cross, but like more other organizations who are doing a lot of work, and it's great and incredible. But if you have the privilege of actually knowing somebody from Ukraine and talking to them and asking how you can help through them, it would probably reach bigger impact faster than you like donating to a big organization. And I know this for a fact because my two friends from the university, like for the first 2-3 weeks, they couldn't like sleep. They couldn't do and sit abroad and do nothing. So they organized this like small like fund. They created an Excel spreadsheet where they would track like everything that people donated to them, because they had like US bank accounts and they have Venmo, PayPal, and all of those like different means of like getting, and they would encourage all of like their international friends to donate. And over the course of like 3-4 weeks, they raised more than 1 million hryvnia, which is really a lot for two college students. And they also spent that million hryvnia on sending like money to the territorial defense, to buying like helmets and buying the body armors, or sending money for essential medicine for like elderly, for food, for people who fled their homes and had nowhere to live, or like they were just with kids and like, you know, one suitcase, sending money to even like the barrels of either soldiers who died or people who died from the shellings or direct, you know, fire of Russia. And the messages they received, like, as, you know, thank you, were so beautiful. And you could see that it's actually making such a huge impact, because I don't know if those people could have gotten that support as quick as they did.
Yeah, folks. I mean, listen to this. I think we've been telling and talking and discussing this more in previous episodes. This is very important, what Yulia says. When it comes to donations at the moment to Ukraine, it's much better if you trust, if you know people, it's much better to donate to individuals and also smaller initiatives that are on the ground or have the means, you know, basically Ukrainians who run initiatives from abroad and have the means to transfer money right away, than to bigger organizations. In my personal experience, I helped to fundraise for zoos, for queer communities, queer families back in Ukraine, and they received money instantly. Some bigger organizations that fundraised tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions, those money are still haven't arrived to Ukraine.
Yeah. It's insane. It's insane. And that's, on one hand, like, I understand why, like, you know, like, obviously all of these, like, concerts, like, for example, the concert that the UK had, like, you know, collecting donations and fundraisers, they need to be somehow, like, you know, legal and, like, have that, like, you know, accountability of an institution or organizations, because people trust it more and they know that they have some sort of plan. But just, like, if you ever doubt, like, right now, I think every single Ukrainian that I know is trying to do something to help us to win and to help people in need. Like, there is not a single Ukrainian who just, like, sits and just, you know, does nothing or thinks, like, what is the next, like, expensive computer I'm going to buy? Like, I got donations for myself from my university friends who are like, we just want you to have the money because you left your home and you, like, don't have... I've already spent some of those money on donating for Ukrainian armed forces or, like, to people that I know that post on Instagram that they need, like, some specific thing. So if you give it directly to the people, they will make a way of it, you know, making the difference.
Everyone's affected, and people also need to understand that Ukraine is a massive country, 40 million people. Each and everyone is affected in a profound way. And we have already impact of $500 billion on, destroyed infrastructure, destroyed it's our crazy. Homes, cities.
Yeah.
The amount of money that we, you know, need to rebuild it is just insane. But also, on the personal level, those incomes that were erased for many for more than a month. You know, this is, I mean, we hope for reparations one day from Russia, at least from all those frozen tens of billions across the world.
Yeah. Yeah.
But for now, this we'll is something everyone can do. Yeah, we will. Julia, I wanted to ask you a very important also question, because you have a very a great perspective. You've been doing it before the genocide. You're doing it now. When it comes to key misconceptions about Ukraine, and I know you touched a bit about it before, what would you really single out at the moment that, you know, just drives you mad, that people, especially foreigners, especially in the West, really get wrong about Ukraine, and something that you really passionate about? What we should decolonize right here, right now?
The one that is a really big one for me, and something that I noticed with, like, more progressive peers from abroad, is how uncomfortable people are donating to or, like, somehow helping or supporting any militaristic cause. And I feel like by doing that, they completely misunderstand what's happening here in Ukraine. So a lot of people actually saying, like, you can't donate to the military because it's, like, against my morals. I don't want to support any, like, you know, violence.
Oh my God.
And it's like, yes, a lot of those people come from the countries, Western countries, who have also been colonizers and who have also gone on, like, imperialistic missions to other countries in order to, you know, support or do any of their dirty things drove by just economic interest. And
kill,
I get
loot and rape. Yeah.
Yes. And I get why a lot of people, like, you know, become sort of like anti-military in that way, especially those who come from those countries, because they know that all kind of, like, the wars that they fought were either, like, overseas or were for, like, nothing. But something that I tell all of those people is that I don't think it's an over-exaggeration to say that the reason why I'm still alive and my grandparents and my dad are still alive is because there is somebody fighting to defend them every single day. There is somebody putting their life down every single day so we can stay safe here. Or, like, even those people in the front lines. We're not trying to, like, take somebody's, like, territory. We're not trying to, pursue any, like, imperialistic goals or expand Ukraine. We're simply trying to survive here and to preserve our country and preserve our internationally recognized borders. It's very different from, I don't know, our president sending troops on a mission to another country for something that we, like, don't understand that's happening. And supporting Ukrainian military, you're supporting the life of other Ukrainians. So like you can see it as a like humanitarian cause as well, because those money are most likely going to be spent on like, you know, the anti-aircraft missile systems that right now protecting me in Lviv, so Russian missiles do not get to the civilian areas. Because actually, like the last time when 4 days ago, I think Lviv was attacked and 3 missiles fell, I think around 16 were actually turned down by the anti-aircraft or anti-missile system here in Lviv. So it's actually working, but we need more and more and more of that kind of equipment of, you know, so we can stay alive here. And I feel like a lot of people miss that point. Like, yes, if you feel like you'd rather donate to some like very specific cause that is like, you know, food or medicine or something, this is great as well. But if you have an ability to also donate to Ukrainian military, but you sort of like hesitate, just please remember that you're donating directly to save the lives of the people, because that's what Ukrainian military does.
I don't even understand what is the pacifism in a country where, like, when there is a missile, is heading
flying in your direction. Yeah.
Yeah. Or is there a gun pointed at you, or you're being shot at? What, like, how pacifism should work? Like, if I should be a pacifist, how does it, like, work? Just be roll over, die?
Yeah.
I just ask this question all the time to pacifists who say, like, oh, this is so wrong to donate money to or support Ukraine military. How do you, like, imagine this is, you know,
what else do we do?
To the core, that pacifism is a luxury that people enjoy in countries that are not at war or not being attacked. It's a luxury, and to the point that people stop even realizing that it is a luxury and privilege that they have. And people like Ukrainians not have that anymore.
Yeah.
Not anymore.
And on a pragmatic level as well, if for the people who need pragmatic reasons to donate to the army, it's very well coordinated. If people are worried about humanitarian aid and coordination in that side of things, the army one, there's one account that you can transfer money to that is to support the army, that is then coordinated centrally, and that is used for the reasons that are most needed for us at different points in time. As we said, the situation changes. You know, one day you might need one thing, another day you might need something else. And so it's just super important. I think, Yuda, thank you so much for bringing up this point. I think we haven't yet discussed this in our spaces, but it's just really important to bring up. And I don't know if I'm just going to say straight away, slight trigger warning for those who might find this disturbing. Around sexual violence, but I don't know if you guys saw today, also the Times published a story of a woman who was raped by a Russian soldier, and it's the first actual criminal proceeding and investigation into a story like that. And you know, there are plenty of stories like that, but I think it's so brave of people who have experienced some of these, you know, intense levels of violence that Yuda was talking about as well. It's just so brave of people to come forward and talk about it and make their stories known. That I think that's, you know, part, you know, we keep talking about having Ukrainian voices heard and making sure that Ukrainian people's stories are highlighted in the world in the context of this war. And I just think, fortunately or unfortunately, like, it is the only thing that will humanize this level of suffering and threshold of suffering that we're going through right now. It's the people.
Yeah, it's that story is just haunts me still. Like, I've read it many times. Especially, you know, the kid who during night and he does not realize that his father was shot, and he just looks at his body and he cannot recognize that. is just something that probably will stay with so many of this kind of picture. And yeah, and again, coming back, you just, people do not understand that this is something that we cannot get back to normal or, you know, roll back. This is something that forever is there. And this is not something you can compromise or negotiate after seeing something, hearing, reading, experiencing something like that. Yeah, we should wrap up.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, although like it's been amazing.
Yeah, absolutely amazing. To maybe wrap up, I wanted to ask Yulia before she goes, just to end on a more, I guess, hopeful note to show people what Ukraine means to us. Just in a couple of words, Yulia, what does Ukraine mean to you? What values does it bring forward in your mind and your heart?
I think I would say family, because I've never felt more connected with like so many people, and I've never felt such a sense of unity as I feel now in Ukraine. But also bravery, because I see bravery every time I step out on the street of people doing like the smallest acts to like huge acts of bravery and kindness to support each other and help. And as I said about that guy who went from like my village to another town to buy medicine, and he delivered medicine to my grandparents as well, that you don't have to be on the front lines to be a hero in this. Like, obviously all of those who are on the front lines are already heroes, but also every person who's doing something is a hero of their own kind. So this is what Ukraine means for me right now.
That's beautiful. Thank you so much.
And also to wrap it up, I also wanted to really say that the friends that we, you know, as a queer person, I know very well the meaning of chosen family. This is something much more and sometimes powerful than family by blood. And the friends that showed up for us. This is some probably friends that we will have for the rest of our lives. And I'm really grateful that even in these darkest times, we finally have the ability to get new friends, learn about new friends, but also realize who is our friends, who are our friends and who are not. Thank you so much. I want to encourage everyone to use hashtag Ukrainian Spaces. Please leave your comments, maybe suggestions who you want to hear, maybe topics that you want to decolonize and, you know, Ukrainians to feature. But we will try to accommodate everyone's desires and requests.
And also just to say quickly, massive thank you to Yulia for joining us. I know your time is very precious, and you're calling us from Lviv, and we just are really grateful to have you with us today.
You're a star. Thank you so much.
No, thank you guys as well, you, Maxim, and Valeria. It's just incredible work that you're doing promoting Ukrainian voices all around the world. And yeah, thanks to you, it's like easier for us to reach more people. So I'm really, really grateful. And yeah, excited for more talks to come here.
Yep, stop by anytime. Okay, Slava Ukraini.
All right, Slava.